It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Sometimes to understand the place you come from, you have to leave for a while. That's what our next guest did. Returning to rural Wisconsin after time away, she turned her camera to a familiar landscape and saw it in a new way. She shares the results in her new book. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you live in a rural area? Did you move away? What is it like when you go back to visit? Do you try to capture images, whether it's with a camera or painting or drawing? What do you set your eyes on when you try to convey the idea of living in the rural Midwest? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Erin Springer is a photographer based in Menominee, Wisconsin and Brooklyn, New York. Her work has been featured in The New Yorker and The New York Times. Erin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
First, can you set the scene for us? Tell us about the landscape, the community you set out to take pictures in by Menominee.
Yeah, so I grew up outside of Menominee. I went to elementary through high school in Colfax, actually. And I moved away in 2011 and went to school in New York City for college. And then, like you said, after living away for a while, about 10 years, I just became increasingly interested and compelled to go home and make some photos. And I started making the work really during the Thanksgiving holiday when my family would come home to do deer hunting and get together. That was kind of our big holiday. So the first photos in the project really came from that period with them. And then it sort of just sparked into kind of its own life and its own world. And I was really fascinated by the way that we could translate emotions by photographing the landscape and people and combining the two. And that's a big part of the book.
And there you are back in, rural Wisconsin outside of Menominee there after spending time in New York City. You were there. You were looking at the scenery. I think it was COVID, the midst of the pandemic. What felt different to you being there and turning your camera on this place that had once been so familiar to you?
Well, I think it still felt very familiar. I think I just had a bit different perspective. I think that, I grew up with a very typical rural upbringing, but in contrast to the urban life that I was sort of living as an adult through my 20s, I sort of realized that living rurally was quite unique, or it can be quite unique, and also seen sort of from an insider, outsider perspective. Because I remember when I first moved away, and I'd come home, it was just kind of every day. It didn't really strike me as, these interesting sort of scenes of, my aunt's, cow roaming around the farmyard or whatever these typical scenes might be. But the more time that I spent away, just the more I saw them from, I guess, for their unique value in a way that I hadn't really realized when I was living there, when I was much younger. So, I don't know. I can't say anything necessarily felt different. I just sort of had a different perspective. And I think I just had grown a lot as a creative person and an artist and was able to sort of translate those thoughts and that realization kind of in a unique way, or sort of distill it through photography.
And when I see art portraying rural life, I think oftentimes it's like, nostalgic. And sometimes it's sort of in the American Gothic, looking at it from a city perspective. I don't see either of those here. I feel like you're showing us life there. Could you talk about how you tried to, it seems like to me anyway, you kind of avoided both of those.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I guess it wasn't sort of conscious, in trying to avoid one thing or the other. I think my interest in photography stems from documentary work. And I was, as objective as I try to be about certain situations or the way I'm looking at things, I very much feel that my emotions are present and also just a huge part of what translates into the photos and how I feel and look at things. I guess there's not a whole lot of sentimentality or nostalgia, but I think that's inherent almost in a way to every photograph, because it's sort of this external memory and looking at the past, even if it was yesterday, or 5, 10, 20 years ago. But I think I just was really interested in sort of capturing the atmosphere that I felt when I went home, the starkness of the landscape, the way that people interact with it. And sort of the warmth that's present amongst such a cold period, literally the dormant season or the dormant period of the year. I found that tension to be really, really interesting. And I think probably too, just with the edit and the way that it's all put together, it kind of removes you from that sort of nostalgic perspective and gives you more of a maybe straightforward look at it. As much as the emotions are involved and present in it, I think it's a little bit more straightforward than sentimental.
Talking to Erin Springer, photographer. Her new book is Dormant Season, which includes photos from her hometown. Her home community is just outside of Menominee here in Wisconsin. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Some of your photos are landscapes, some involve animals, but there are human subjects in them. And I understand some of them are relatives, some of them are not. How was it working with family and community members here?
Yeah. So the work started with my immediate family. I was making the photos initially when I would be home for Thanksgiving. And that was sort of just this, there wasn't real specific intention. That's the way I've always sort of interacted and participated in different family events. And I've always been just really compelled to capture the moments with my family. But then this work started growing into something that I felt was much bigger and should and could be expanded into the community. And, the more time I spent with my family in sort of familiar settings, the more curious I was about foreign settings, even if it was just, neighbors next door. You don't really realize how many times you might drive by a farm or see somebody in a town nearby that you don't know. And, without approaching them or literally knocking on their door, you may never know about them or their life. And I really, I learned a lot from people that I would approach sort of at random. And it's definitely different challenges working with family versus community, and strangers, but, everybody that's in this work, I've developed a personal relationship with that I think will kind of carry on throughout my life. So I feel really, really fortunate for everybody that had their open doors to me. It's just amazing, like how many different situations you can get in when you just let your curiosity sort of steer the way and follow your instincts and approach people. And, most often people are open and curious as well. Even if they're not familiar with the type of photography that I was interested in making, we had that sort of mutual interest in each other and what I was trying to do. And for me, how they were living and who they are. So, it worked out really well. I feel really, really fortunate to have worked with the people that I did and encountered in very unexpected ways.
I want to visit a couple of the photos here, and I'm looking at one right now, and this is selfish. I didn't grow up on the family farm, grew up visiting my great uncle's family farm, fond memories of time in the hayloft. And you've got a picture, a bunch of kids, it's almost set up like an amphitheater in the hayloft there. Can you tell us a little bit about that image?
Yeah. So I guess to describe the picture a bit, the group of kids are hanging out in the hayloft, which is the upper level of a barn, for anybody that might not be familiar. And there's two boys hanging from the rafters, and there's other kids and a cat seated on top of some stacked hay bales. And they're all talking amongst themselves. Nobody's making direct eye contact. And we're sort of just enveloped by this, amphitheater, like you said. When I first saw that scene, I thought, wow, this is like a cathedral. the light is streaming in and, the light's reflected from the particles in the hay and the air. I got to this image. It actually was a pretty long buildup to this because I was with my uncle and my cousin who were loading soybeans at this farm just a year prior. And I'd always driven, this is kind of the perfect classic example of what I was saying earlier, where I was always driving by this farm and I knew of the family that lived there, but I'd never actually been to the farm. So I went with my uncle and my cousin and just to spend time with them. And there was a bunch of kids running around the farmyard and, just struck up conversation with one of the teenagers. And I learned that there's a one-room school there with 15 or so kids, ages 6 to about 17, so every grade. And, within that conversation, I talked to the farmer that lives there, and his daughter has the school. And he told me that it was actually my great, great, great grandfather that built that barn. So I just thought, wow, like this is so how, you know, the things you learn just by asking a few questions. And, you know, this was only 5 miles from where I grew up, but I hadn't known that prior to that visit. So I sort of took that as a sign and I started spending time at the school the following year. I was really thinking about this, you know, I think I was on my way back to New York when I first met the kids at the school, and I was there on that initial visit with my uncle. But yeah, I really just kind of took this as a sign, and I was so curious about this. I just really wanted to explore what the school was like too. Just like the fact that there was kids learning on a school was, or sorry, learning on a farm was really interesting. So yeah, then I just went back the following fall and spent a lot of time with the kids, and that photo was made on their sort of recess lunch break. It was cold outside and they spend time in the barn and play with the kitties, and that was sort of where they congregate. And yeah, we just had a lot of fun, and I made that picture of them, and just really, yeah, it was a really special experience for me. And I really am really glad for that moment in that photo.
We're talking to photographer Erin Springer about her new book. It's called Dormant Season, which captures life in rural Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you see beauty in rural Wisconsin life? The people, the places, the buildings, the landscapes. Do you try to capture those through photos or drawing or painting or writing? Do you have a favorite artist who portrays what life is like in the rural Midwest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with photographer Erin Springer about her new book, Dormant Season, a collection of photos of life in rural Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you try to catch images of rural Wisconsin on camera or painting or drawing or whatever you might do, love to hear from you what you like to draw. Join in at 800-642-1234. We heard from Bruce in Two Harbors, Minnesota, who said, aside from loving living in a rural part of his state, he thinks the windmill is a great icon of rural landscape. I don't think you have windmills, Erin, but something that really kind of looms over the scenery a lot is the silo. I see that showing up in a few pictures, and that gives, I don't know, it gives like a height to some of the pictures. Could you talk about how you tried to bring silos into? I'm looking at one right now, actually, with some birds doing a flyby.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't really, I hadn't intentionally sort of thought about the incorporation of silos, but maybe there's a subconscious thread there of sort of the storage of memory. Maybe there's something there about, you know, the storage of crops that go into silos throughout the winter. And sort of this project is a sort of container of my memories and expression of my memories. Maybe that's a stretch, but if I had to give a top of mind answer, that might be something going on in my inner mind there.
I love it. We've got Jeff on the line in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Well, hello, good afternoon. I've done the similar thing, moved away and came back. And what I found as I recall these memories, and I wanted to ask the artist here, as part of the creative process that goes into taking a photograph or a scene, does music play a part? Or even after you produce the photograph later, do certain songs remind you of certain scenes? Or as part of the creative process, how does music affect what you do?
Interesting question. Ooh. Jeff. Erin, what do you think?
Yeah, that is such an interesting question. I actually was listening to a song on repeat kind of while I was making this work, and I was really listening to a lot of classical music, a lot of piano and a lot of cello. And I spent so much time just driving around by myself in the landscape and the openness of the sort of winter fields and sky. And I found the classical music to be really really helpful in sort of getting me into a zone of emotion and mood, and also kind of just creating a canvas for me to look at things without having words placed upon them. So the classical music I was listening to was all instrumental. And I thought that that was really, it really was moving to me to, you know, watch snow drifting across the road, watching wind, watching just people from a distance while listening to music that has such, such big crescendos and everything. I thought it was really, really helpful for me, but I hadn't really thought about it as part of the process. I think it was sort of, again, just like a subconscious thing that I would do when I would think of it, and I would sort of need another spark, you know, to get me into a mindset to make photos or feel a certain type of way.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. I can't leave it hanging, Aaron. What song were you listening to on repeat in particular?
I knew you were going to ask, and I need to, hold on. Let me pull this up here. Let's see. I've got my, I can never remember the name. It's one that I hadn't heard before I sort of put on a shuffle in classical music here. I've got a playlist. Sorry for the
here. Was it actually just building the suspense for me? I don't know about anybody else.
I know. Here it is. Okay. It's by Anya Lechner, and it's called Vague, and then it's / En la Nave Va. And it's from her album Lontano.
All right, we're gonna get a link on our segment note for that. Aaron, as we wrap up, just briefly, one thing that really strikes me, you put the photos in the book, you don't have captions, you don't have descriptions. What led to that decision, just letting those photos stand for themselves?
Well, I think it's important for viewers to have their own interpretation of the work. I think what you feel and what you glean from a body of visual work is as relevant as what maybe the artist did making it. And so I just really, the mystery of it and the openness and the all the different forms that it can take on and the spaces that it can occupy in your mind, if you aren't overly explicative with things and you don't explain what's necessarily happening, I think can be really helpful for a visual project like this. You know, it's not specific to one person, one place, or even one story. It's really to evoke a feeling and convey sort of a more generalized mood. So I think that that's, I think not having captions and not having explanations is helpful for that.
Aaron, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for sharing your work with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Aaron Springer, a photographer based in Menominee here in Wisconsin and Brooklyn, the New York kind of Brooklyn, not our Wisconsin Brooklyn. Her work has been featured in The New Yorker and The New York Times. She was with us to talk about her new photo book, Dormant Season, with lots of pictures of places, people, and landscape near Menominee. More than 20,000 people living in Wisconsin have cases pending in immigration court that could result in deportation. But the vast majority of those people won't be represented by a lawyer. As Sarah Lear reports, there's a growing and unmet demand for immigration attorneys in Wisconsin and across the country.
On a recent spring afternoon, more than 30 people file into the basement of a church in Madison. Some carry babies in strollers and slings. They settle into plastic chairs as attorney Aisa Olivares of the Community Immigration Law Center cues up a slideshow. The people in the crowd are new arrivals to the U.S. Some are seeking asylum. That means they need to prove they left their home countries because they fear persecution for characteristics like their race or their politics. They typically have a year to turn in government paperwork. The form must be completed in English. And the process often involves recounting trauma, like imprisonment, sexual assault, or torture. They need help. But with only 3 attorneys on staff, the center doesn't have the resources to give one-on-one legal advice to everyone. Paralegal Diana Benitez says the nonprofit has no choice but to turn many people away.
It's desperate. It's just the level of desperation people have when they come to speak with you is just really... it's palpable. It's just, you can see it on your face.
In 2019, there were more than 1 million pending U.S. immigration cases. Today, that backlog has surpassed 3 million. Sue Long directs the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, which analyzed the federal data. She says insufficient court funding is partly to blame.
They haven't had the budget to increase the number of immigration judges and support staff that are needed to hold hearings and make decisions, compared to increasing the budget, for example, for the Border Patrol.
And when immigrants end up in court, data also shows they're less likely to have lawyers. 5 years ago, immigrants nationwide had legal representation in 65% of pending deportation cases. Now, only 30% do. In the U.S., criminal defendants have a right to an attorney, but that right does not apply to immigration cases. Annie Chen is with the Vera Institute of Justice, a left-leaning think tank. She says the system has created an imbalance.
The government is always represented by a trained attorney, but the immigrant is often in immigration court alone.
When immigrants have attorneys, studies show they're more likely to be released on bond if they're detained. They're also less likely to be deported. Barb Graham oversees refugee and immigration legal services for Catholic Charities in Milwaukee. It's one of a handful of organizations in Wisconsin that handles immigration cases on a free or pro bono basis. Graham says her clients can't afford to pay thousands of dollars for complicated and lengthy cases.
People who are applying for asylum have left everything. They come up with nothing. They have no access to money. They have no access to, they didn't come with their bank account.
But even when people can afford to pay, Graham says private immigration attorneys can be in short supply. Border Patrol encounters with migrants at the southern border reached a record high last year. And Milwaukee immigration attorney Teddy Chadwick says demand for his services has risen exponentially.
I have court hearings that are scheduled out until 2028 and 2029.
Faced with a backlog, Chadwick says there's often nothing immigrants or asylum seekers can do to make their cases go faster. And he says those cases can be all but impossible to navigate without an attorney. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.